This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. We've got two very interesting books today on the general region east of the Hindu Kush Mountains in western South Asia, essentially along the Indus River into the mountains and then a little bit farther west. The books are Alice Albina's Empires of the Indus, The Story of a River, which is a fascinating exploration both historically and personally of one of the great rivers of the world. And then in the second half of the program, I'm going to be talking with Seth Jones, author of In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. The two regions, as we'll see, are intimately interconnected, much more so than I realized before I started reading either of them. And Alice Albina will be in the Bay Area next week. She'll be doing a book reading and discussion next Sunday from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Justice and Peace Center, 48 South 7th Street in San Jose. And on Monday, she'll be reading from 5 to 7 p.m. at Stevens Hall, number 10, the CSAS conference room at UC Berkeley. This is sponsored by the South Asia Studies and Center for South and Southeast Asian Studies and the Friends of South Asia and a couple of other organizations. So if you want more information about that, you can call csas@berkeley.edu, or I can give you more information. This will all be on the blog. I don't want to tell you all of it, but there's two opportunities to meet the author of a really fascinating book, and I believe she's on the line right now. Welcome to Booktown, Alice.
Thank you.
Before I read this, I have been in India 45 years ago, but I'd never been close to the Indus. And from what I knew historically about it being one of the first centers of human civilization, along with the Nile Valley and the Fertile Crescent of the Tigris and Euphrates and the river valleys in China, I thought that the Indus was somewhat like the Nile or the Tigris and Euphrates, just a big, slow-moving river that dropped lots of silt around it and that became basically a farming area. And I find out from reading this book that I was probably totally wrong.
Not totally wrong.
There's a part, but not very much.
In the lower stretches of the river, it was always exactly as you describe, a winding, silty, very fertile river plain. But it has this it has many different avatars, and it's a wild mountain river as well, higher up.
And I guess that's the aspect that the Greeks knew about before and after Alexander the Great conquered parts of that area. They found the river almost terrifying.
They did. I mean, they came across the river in the monsoon, and they'd been marching across half the world in their eyes, upland and dry, through these dry hilly areas, and then they arrived in this, what they thought was this ghastly, mosquito-y, snaky region, and the river completely defeated them. It was this amazing moment where the river spilt its banks and all the tributaries they were trying to cross, these different tributaries of the River Indus in the monsoon, and the soldiers hated it, and there was a mutiny. Alexander had a mutiny on his hands, and it's more or less down to the Indus and its monsoon. the flooding of the river, and they tried to take their boats down the river, and there's all these terrifying descriptions of this force, which they eventually had to worship. They made libations to the river alongside their own gods. So quite a moment.
They weren't the only ones to worship the river. There were quite a few river gods, and we'll get into that in a minute. But first, I should let the audience know that two of the fascinating factors about this book, one is that it is full of historical information, but the historical information essentially goes backwards because you follow the river from its delta into the Arabian Ocean and then go back up it to its headwaters in Tibet. I guess this took you 4 years to do.
It took a long time, yeah, it did take a long time. And it was really a way, I mean, the way going upstream, it was, firstly, I obviously had to get to the source, and I couldn't just arrive at the source, I had to get there. And exploring the river in this way, backwards, made sense to me, practically speaking. I wanted to unpick the history, these layers and layers and layers of history and conquest and reconquest. So there was a kind of, there was also a sense of this romantic historical idea of the very, very first people who ever came to this river would have come along the coast in the reverse direction of people like Alexander the Great, and then they would have come across this big, slow, silty river and then gradually gone upstream and eventually, after thousands of years, arrived at the source.
And as you go upstream, on your way to the source, you go backwards historically through each chapter is a chunk of time that it could cover a couple of decades or it could cover a couple of hundred years, and you find one salient event in that period and then describe what happened before and after. And it's quite a tangle of different nationalities, different types of civilization, different types of ways of living, different religions. For the most part, I get the impression that, with some exception, all of these different people came to an accommodation with one another and lived more or less easily, or maybe uneasily, with one another right up till modern times.
Exactly. I mean, I think maybe because a river of this stature has naturally draws people, and it's a river which runs through a desert in the southern, in its lower reaches, so it's always going to be pulling people to it. And of course, you have to cross a river, and you draw the water out of the river to fertilize your fields. So it's always a meeting point. But one of the really amazing things about the Indus is that, in terms of India, it was the first place that the very early Muslim traders, conquerors, invaders, saints, Sufi saints, travelers got to. And so it has the earliest contact between Islam and Hinduism in the whole of South Asia. And therefore you get this, as you say, this amazing centuries-old accommodation between Islam and the various different forms of Hinduism. And this is something which persists today. So you get these shrines in southern Pakistan where the very same figure will be worshipped as a Hindu god by Hindus and as a Muslim saint by Muslims, and they all come together, these two religions which now seem so opposed to each other. And these people, these local people, whether they're Muslim or Hindu, will come together and still today worship this figure.
But it's not nearly as easy a relationship as it was before partition.
No, it's now very fraught.
In 1947, when the lines were drawn between the two countries, some of them seemed quite arbitrary, and it led to massive migrations and massive bloodshed.
Yes, a lot of death, people having to be uprooted from where they'd, you know, their ancestral places, because of the fact that they were one religion or the other. And nevertheless, there are still, the surprising thing for me during my journey and my just research and the process of discovery for this book was that in southern Pakistan, in Sindh, the province of Sindh, these links still exist despite politics, despite the last 50 years. These things are deeper than that, I think. You know, 60 years isn't a very long time when you're talking about something so strong as culture and faith.
And one of the most amazing groups that I knew nothing about were the descendants of African slaves, who are fairly numerous in Sindh province.
Yep. So this again is the East African slave trade, and it's a centuries-old trade. These slaves, when the British conquered Sindh in 1843, one of the things they did, one of the proclamations they made to justify this act of just brutal colonization done were freed. But you still see in Pakistan that the places that those Shidis were brought to as slaves, the descendants are still living there in very much in the same place, still doing laboring jobs. There is this racism which is expressed in Muslim culture, which should be without caste and without racism, but it's still expressed very much in social forms in Pakistan. And this is one of my favorite chapters because it really was an exploration of this particular family who was still living in the place that their ancestors were brought to as slaves, but the grandfather father of the family had written this book in 1952 about Shidis and about the fact that these Shidis were they were the original Muslims. That was what the Shidis, that was their kind of rallying cry to themselves and to fellow Muslims in Pakistan.
Because I guess one of Mohammed's strongest companions was an African.
Exactly. Even this man, Bilal, with a beautiful voice who called the faithful to prayer.
One of the interesting differences between East African Muslim slavery and West African Christian slavery, although both could be quite brutal, was that the slaves taken in the Islamic countries quite often rose to positions of great power.
Mm-hmm.
And that when the British freed them in 1843, they suddenly lost this power.
They did. You see it all over India. In fact, when the British come into India and begin this slow process of colonization and conquest, these African, there's been African leaders, there's been African kings, there's been, these people have in various parts of India held positions of power. And almost immediately with the British colonization, piecemeal colonization of India, this is undermined, and it's not really the importance of this meeting of cultures isn't recognized by the British. And you see a sudden, despite, there's this irony that despite the fact that the British make a great song and dance about freeing these African slaves, in fact, there's a loss of status.
Now, I was just going to go on to some of the other topics. There are so many of them that you've talked about the saints who are worshipped under different names along the river.
Mm.
The religions have gotten very closely intertwined, that Sufism was a form of Islam that probably had strong Hindu elements, and Sikhism, which also arose in this area, took a lot of inspiration from both Hinduism and Islam, and it gets very complicated the way all of these four groups intermingle, and then when you throw in the Buddhists, it gets really complicated. You give each of these a chapter. Is there a particular thread that you see going among all the interactions of the various religions?
I think just that when people come together, even with these, they're very different conceptions of the world and of religion and faith, you have these forms which seem as if they can never come together, like oil and water. And in fact, just by the process of people living together, meeting, sharing the same space for partying or religion or talking, these whether it's a religion such as Hinduism, which has this belief in reincarnation, or a religion such as Islam, which absolutely doesn't. Nevertheless, the two find some accommodation somehow, and it's often a space, this often happens in a space where outside the organized church, outside the temples, outside the mosques, it's the, and often it's these much more anarchic meeting places. And in Pakistan, at least, these are the shrines of saints, and they really are amazing places, even now. So one of the things that really interested me was that women who, rural Muslim women who lead these quite circumscribed lives in Pakistan, and one of the ways in which they can get away from their families and away from their children and away from the constraints that are put on them in daily life is to go to one of these Sufi shrines. And there are some amazing scenes of women, women obviously doing purdah in a burqa, so completely closed, her face is covered, but swinging themselves backwards and forwards to the beat of this music, and all the men are dancing freely, of course, but the women beating themselves backwards and forwards, you know, here they've got away from their homes and they've come to these shrines, and they're, it's like a rave. If you didn't know it was Pakistan, you would think it was some rave in, I don't know, in the Bay Area or somewhere, London. It was really quite inspiring to see how, what people can do to let themselves, to get themselves free, really.
You talk about dancing all the way up the river. You also talk about the position of women all the way up the river. And it seems that the farther up the river and the farther back in history you go, the stronger position women have.
Well, yeah, there were these legends which do seem to have some truth about these northern regions where women rule, where the men have to do exactly as the women say, and where there's always been these strong women leaders. And of course, it's curious. It may just be a coincidence. This may be one of the reasons why the legend started. But in Ladakh, so that's the very, very northern part of India, and in Tibet, you have a very, very different arrangement of families, whereby one woman will marry two or three or four brothers. And this, of course, this polyandry is seen nowadays, it's recognized nowadays as a way of conserving resources, because you keep population down in a landscape where resources are very scarce. And it's interesting that historically this form of family structure has been viewed with huge suspicion by outsiders, whether they're Chinese officials or British commentators. Throughout history, this has been seen as something that's disgusting and degrading by outsiders. And in fact, it's when you go there, you see that actually it's good for women. It's in this particular environment, it's a really good way for women to have control of their lives and their families, and to conserve resources. And it's almost as if these people have come up with an answer to a lot of the problems of the world, and it's a practice that's been going on for centuries, obviously.
And that is a practice that is reflected in some of the great Hindu literature, but in a way that is almost unrecognizable. On the whole question of whether there ever were Aryans, a group of northerners who descended into India, and essentially took over from the existing people, at least took over ruling. This is still, after hundreds of years, a very controversial topic, and people nobody is really agreed on who came when or what they did. But you do indicate that the writings of some of the Vedas, especially the Rig Veda, is very clearly set in the Indus Valley and among those rivers. Yeah. And many of the cultural patterns there, including polyandry, were probably prevalent in early times. But then as these Aryans or whoever they were moved down into the plain of the Ganges and became sort of settled Indians, they began to look askance at what they'd done when they were by the river.
Yes, there were these wonderful scathing descriptions of the people of the Indus Valley in much later Sanskrit texts. So there were these comments about the women of the Indus dancing naked and the men eating too much garlic. Generally, you shouldn't go there. You shouldn't go to this land. Or if you do go to this land, you should remember that it's dangerous. And even if the women are dancing and the horses are beautiful and the Sanskrit is also very beautiful, sonorous Sanskrit that is spoken there, you should be careful because it's a kind of debased place. And there's this gradual historical amnesia within the Sanskrit texts themselves about the fact that actually the Rig Veda, the earliest and most sacred Sanskrit text of all, is written about the Indus Valley. And that's very clear in the Rig Veda that it's the Indus, which is the mother and the father of all rivers. And as you say, these Vedic people gradually, over hundreds and thousands of years, they shift eastward into the Ganges. And the Indus, having been the center of the civilization, is shifted to the periphery and is looked upon askance. And many of the practices that were once commonplace are now seen as looked upon as with suspicion. And it's amazing that this split endures right to the present day. So in India, at the moment, there is this great problem about the way in which you talk about the Aryans and the Aryan migration into India. And for right-wing Hindu nationalists, it's something that is fiercely contended. There are political parties in India who want to have, indeed, tried to rewrite the history textbooks in India in order to disprove this notion of a migration of an Aryan people into India. They want to say that the Aryans were indigenous to India. And what was very curious for me, having lived in Delhi for 2 years where this debate was raging at the time, then to go to Pakistan where every Pakistani with any sense of social superiority considers themselves actually an immigrant to Pakistan, whether it's because they're descended from the Prophet or their ancestors came from Persia. And so in Pakistan, the academic discourse is totally different, and there's absolutely no problem with the concept of an Aryan migration into the Indus Valley, and therefore a lot of the interesting archaeological research on this topic is being done in Pakistan on the banks of the Indus. So because of this accident of history in 1947, this plays out even now in the way that people look at ancient history.
And going even more ancient, the whole question of the first Indus Valley civilizations, which we associate with the cities of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, those are quite controversial now, and how they connect with modern India and Pakistan is quite unclear.
So this is an incredible city civilization of 3000 BC, and it's really... It was something that was discovered comparatively recently. So in the 1920s, these cities were suddenly discovered. They predate the Vedic Aryan civilization that we were just talking about. Incredibly sophisticated town planning. People who seem to be obsessed with water, living by this great river. So every house has an excellent bath system, drainage. These people were bathing the whole time. And they also had, they were trading. They were trading not only in the Indus Valley from the Himalayas where they were bringing down cedar, but they were trading as far away as Mesopotamia. And you see this, the links between the two cultures in the archaeology and the things they, the goods they exchanged and the seals that they used as markers for their goods. And suddenly the civilization died out. And there were all these intriguing theories about why it happened, whether it was the river changing course or the river flooding or over-resource use. So there are parallels with the situation today, but also it could have been the Aryan people coming in and destroying them somehow. And yes, it's an eerie story of sudden collapse of civilization.
The other thing that interested me was from what I knew about the culture, I associated it with those two big cities, and I thought there were those and then a few little villages, but it turns out that there were dozens, hundreds of large cities that were almost identical.
Yeah, it had a huge range from the Himalayas right down to the sea, and yes, carbon copy town planning all the way along this enormous stretch of the river. It really was quite amazing, and one of the things I liked in particular was seeing how these very sophisticated city people were trading and coexisting with people right up in the mountains who were still living in very primitive huts and following quite a different way of life. But you see in the archaeology, you see that the two were meeting and trading, and that there were links between the two. And therefore, this idea that we were talking about at the beginning of these overlapping histories and this tangle of religion and culture, really, even as far back as that, you see it quite clearly in the history, in the way that the river has brought these very, very different people together.
As I mentioned at the beginning, the book is a combination of your personal experiences and historical background. Mm. And we're getting low on time, so I can't go too much into that. I should just tell our listeners, though, that the two most fascinating personal adventures are going in and out of Afghanistan while you were trying to trace Alexander the Great's roots, and then going into Tibet to find the actual source of the Indus.
Mm.
And I'll just tell people that they are fascinating and gripping. But there's one question I want to get to before we have to end, and that is, your last chapter is called The Disappearing River.
Yes.
And you talk about essentially how the headwaters come out of a spring in Tibet. But you also talk about the fact that the river, as it's been known for all these thousands of years, does seem to be disappearing.
I mean, I realized when I got to Tibet, and this was the most arduous journey, in fact, of the whole book, that the river had been dammed, and therefore that the water body that I'd been following upstream all these months and all these years wasn't actually, in one sense, we can say that it wasn't actually the Indus, because the river had been completely cut off. The Chinese had put a dam in place. Of course, then I went upstream beyond the dam. The culmination of this journey was to reflect on the fact that this great river, which has borne so many civilizations and brought so many people to its banks, really is an endangered river, and that we're sucking water out of it. And the river itself is changing. It's a river that has been known throughout history by the very, very many different people who've come to its banks as a capricious river and a life-giving river and a river that runs forever. And I hope it carries on flowing forever.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome, and I've been talking with Alice Abinya, author of Empires of the Indus, The Story of a River. She'll be speaking at the Justice and Peace Center in San Jose next Sunday, May the 2nd, from 4 to 7 p.m., and at Stevens Hall on the UC Berkeley campus on Monday, May 3rd, from 5 to 7 p.m. So thanks so much for talking with us, Alice, and I hope you have a good journey to California.
I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you. Bye. This is still Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome, and I'll be with you till 2. In the second half of the program, we're shifting just a little bit west of the Indus River, but as I said at the beginning of the program, I've discovered from reading these two books how totally interconnected the Afghanistan, the Hindu Kush Mountains, Pakistan, and the Indus Valley are. And in this second half of the program, I'll be talking with Seth G. Jones, who's author of In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan, which has some background. Most of it covers the last 10 years, and it gives a very detailed and not entirely encouraging picture of what's going on there. Welcome to Booktown, Seth.
Thanks for having me on. It's a great honor to be on.
Oh, well, thanks for coming. you are, I just said that things did not look too good in Afghanistan. There's a whole question of whether the United States should ever have gone in there. There's a question of if we went in the right way. I think you believe that we should be there, but that we went in the wrong way.
Well, I don't think the United States had a lot of choice after the September 11th, 2001 attacks. They didn't originate per se from Afghanistan, because they originated from many places. But at the very least, the organization that was targeting the United States was headquartered in Afghanistan, where they had done a lot of the training preparations, where most of their senior leaders were located. They were closely allied to a Taliban government that controlled Afghanistan and allowed them a sanctuary and safe haven there. So I don't think the U.S. had much choice in that case than to target. Frankly, one of the most abusive human rights regimes in our era, the Taliban. The challenge was, I think, how to do this. And at that point, then, the United States did begin to run into difficulties. They went in with a very small footprint. Initially, they turned towards the war in Iraq as the primary front shortly thereafter. So there are a number of other things, I think, that could have been done better. But I don't call into question the need to go into Afghanistan in the first place.
You call the book In the Graveyard of Empires because particularly the British and the Russians, well, actually you go as far back as Alexander the Great. He seemed to have conquered part of the country but didn't really hold it, and certainly the British and the Russians didn't. The Americans thought that they had learned from those mistakes, that they would do it better. But as you said, this light footprint didn't seem to work. Is there a model from the past that maybe we should pay more attention to? You do mention one in your afterword.
Sure. Well, what's interesting is there clearly are recent periods of relative stability in Afghanistan. The most recent one was during what's often called the Mujahideen dynasty. It was the dynasty run by a range of kings. First Nadir Shah, then followed by his son Zahir Shah, and by various relatives, Daoud Khan, up until about 1978 when he was overthrown and killed. And during that period, there was relative stability. And what's interesting when you look at that period is there was a combination of a central government with a national army, but also a recognition that that power in Pashtun areas in particular was very decentralized. So a recognition that stability had to come from a combination of top-down efforts from the center and bottom-up efforts from local tribes, sub-tribes, clans, and qawms. And so the central government's role was not to control the country, including the countryside and rural areas, but was essentially to cut deals, and over the long run, potentially to expand the power of the center, but it was a long-term process.
Now, I'm going to get into something that you do not say explicitly, but that I've sort of derived from reading your book and the one we discussed in the first half of the program, that Afghanistan has sort of taken its modern boundaries in the 18th century, but it has, over the years, really been an area that was partly dominated by the Persians, the Iranians to the west, partly by Uzbeks to the north or other Turkic groups that came from the north. And then people from Afghanistan would, various conquerors would go down into India and conquer large sections of India, so that it never really had a national identity. And I had the feeling that the various empires that ruled it, they did well as long as they collected taxes and sort of left the people alone. Am I off the mark?
No, I think you're partially on the mark, especially in rural areas. I mean, there are the cities have tended to be a bit more progressive. Individuals, for example, in southern Afghanistan that have moved to Kabul, that may be Nurzais or Popalzais, and now increasingly identify themselves as Kabulis, that is, someone from Kabul. So in that sense, cities may be slightly outside of that, but when it comes to rural areas of the country, sure, I think the government has been essentially most effective when it has left those areas alone to some degree, and that is there have been cases when the government has been needed to get involved in intra-tribal or intra-community disputes or to crush revolts and rebellions, but not generally not to take an active day-to-day role in services and security. It's generally done by locals.
And the question is, who influences the locals? Right now, it seems that the Taliban is resurgent because it knows how to provide services, and the NATO and Americans are just beginning to learn this.
Well, the Taliban strategy and the Afghan government and NATO strategy are very different. Both the NATO and the Afghan government have, since about 2002, primarily focused on stabilizing the country from the top down. The Taliban strategy, if you look at it, I spent virtually all of 2009 working in rural areas of Afghanistan, especially the south and the east, and have been going back and forth for about at least a decade. When you go out into some of the most violent parts of the country and you look at Taliban operations, they do a very sophisticated job of trying to co-opt aggrieved tribes or sub-tribes or clans or qawms, coercing ones that they can't co-opt. So targeted assassination if tribes or sub-tribes won't cooperate with them. So it's a very sophisticated local strategy where they're approaching individuals, tribal leaders or sub-tribal leaders at the village level. And they do offer in these areas justice. It's not the formal justice system that the Afghan government is trying to establish, but it's a much more nuanced Sharia type system in rural areas. So very, very different types and philosophies behind both competing organization strategies.
Now, the Taliban are only one of the groups that you would broadly classify as insurgents. Who are all the people that are trying to either evade or overthrow the government?
Well, the insurgency is broken down into a series of fronts. In the south, you have the Taliban as the largest organization, obviously in conjunction with a range of their allied tribes, sub-tribes, clans, drug trafficking organizations, and a range of other actors. As you move further up the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, then one gets into areas that are predominantly dominated by the Haqqani network, one of the actually individuals that the CIA worked with in the 1980s, Jalaluddin Haqqani. Most of the day-to-day operations are done by his two of his sons, Badruddin and Siraj. And as you move up along the border a little further north into areas like Nuristan and Nangarhar, you're getting into areas that are being run by Hezb Islami, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's Hezb Islami. So, and there are a range of other groups scattered in and around and local networks, in addition to drug trafficking, timber traders, and a range of others, gem traders. But there are probably three or four big insurgent groups that are cooperating in various ways most of the time, not always.
Now, some people who favor withdrawing from Afghanistan would just say, let them work it out themselves. And since there are so many forces competing, some people assume that if we left, the Taliban would just take over. But it might be that one of these other forces would take the day in the end.
Well, I think two of the major groups, the Haqqani Network and the Taliban, do seem to be tied pretty well and cooperate on a fairly regular basis. There has been recent fighting in northern Afghanistan between Hezb Islami and Taliban. So, and they've had a history of fighting in the 1990s. So there has been some infighting between some of these groups, and one would suspect that if there was a withdrawal of U.S. forces, there would be some competition among some of these groups for control of the capital.
And in addition to NATO, the U.S., and the insurgents that we've just been talking about, there's also a strong influence by almost all of Afghanistan's neighbors, Iran, Russia, especially Pakistan, India, China. I didn't realize until reading this quite how many people or how many nations were involved there.
And this is very historic, too. The last several decades, there's been a major involvement from Pakistan, from India, and pretty notable competition between the Indians and the Pakistanis over control and influence in Afghanistan. Obviously, Iran, because of its border along the west, the Russians, Uzbeks, and a range of others. So then, obviously, in addition, one of the groups that I did leave out, mostly operating out of Pakistan, is Al-Qaeda. And there is a and continues to be an Al-Qaeda presence to some degree, and at least an involvement in eastern and parts of southern Afghanistan primarily. So Al-Qaeda does play kind of a force multiplier role in Afghanistan. It's active in supporting these groups fighting NATO forces and Afghan government forces.
And also the Pakistan in particular, and especially its army and its intelligence service, it seems to be very difficult to tell exactly which side they're on.
Well, historically, in this case, I think what Pakistan has done is it plays really both sides. I mean, it's motivated, as with every state in the region, to maximize its own security and other interests in the region. And in cases where militant groups have attacked Pakistan, have conducted suicide attacks in Pakistani cities, they've crossed the line. And Al-Qaeda has done that. The Tariq-e-Taliban Pakistan, what's often called the Pakistani Taliban, have done this, and some other groups. To the degree that other groups like the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani Network primarily focus on fighting in Afghanistan, in those cases, Pakistan's intelligence services have tended to support these groups because they are undermining a government in Kabul, that is President Karzai's government, that is closely allied with Pakistan's enemy, India. So from Pakistan's perspective, this issue gets into a broader what some people call the great game between India and Pakistan.
And that gets even more complicated because the two groups are also fighting in Kashmir, which is quite close to the Afghan border. And I think that the Pakistanis had been supporting Mujahideen in both Afghanistan and in Kashmir, and they may not know how if they really have retained any control over them.
That's right. The other major front, in addition to Afghanistan, is the Kashmir front. That of course, we're talking about a range of other groups, Lashkar-e-Taiba, Jaish-e-Mohammed, and a number of other groups whose goal, or at least part of the goal, is to take Indian-controlled Kashmir and either make it independent, depending on which group we're talking about, or part of Pakistan. So there has been some support from Pakistan's agencies towards that. And of course, also to attacks in India more broadly, including attacks as recently as the 2008 Mumbai attack, which was traced back to Lashkar-e-Taiba in Pakistan.
And then the last factor that you've mentioned but we haven't gone into is the whole question of the drug trade, which has just ballooned in the last decade.
The drug trade has ballooned. We've seen over the last 2 years or so, it appears to have leveled off, at least for the moment. In some cases even declined a little bit. The what's important, in my view, to note about the drug trade, though, is people often focus on the links between the Taliban. Most of the drugs are cultivated in southern Afghanistan, where the Taliban is operating. Most people focus on the connection between the Taliban and drugs, but of course the problem is bigger because it undermines governance in these areas. because what you find is a range of Afghan government officials also involved in making money off the cultivation, production, and trafficking of poppy. It could be on taxation of fields or taxation of roads where poppy is moved on, or a whole range of other activities, protection as poppy is just moved along a general highway, a whole range of ways to make money off of it. This is just as much about Afghan government involvement as it is about Taliban using it for profit.
To sum up, a couple of months ago, at the end of 2009, President Obama decided to greatly increase the number of troops in Afghanistan, but essentially said they'd be gone within 2 years. Do you think this is realistic? Do you think the tide has turned?
Well, I think, to be fair, the point from the president was that, I mean, it doesn't look like there's going to be an increase in U.S. forces, that there'll be a downsizing. But what U.S. footprint will remain is still a subject of notable disagreement, even within the United States government. So I think in that sense, I do think there are some things that can certainly be accomplished. There has been, I think, some progress targeting Taliban in the Central Helmand River Valley. We're about to start on the U.S. is about to start with the Afghans on efforts in Kandahar province. But it will take the average length of any effective counterinsurgency, average length, is about 13 years. So we're about year 8 or 9 right now. For this thing to seriously turn, there'll have to be a presence for 5 or 6, 7 more years at least. And that's a good question, whether the American public is going to be willing to keep U.S. forces in for that long. I would also note, though, that the number of U.S. forces killed has actually been fairly small. I mean, under 1,000 versus 15,000 for the Soviets in actually a shorter time period. So, but this is really the most significant question right now: is how much longer can the American public continue to stomach this?
This is Booktown on KBMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking with Seth G. Jones about In the Graveyard of Empires, America's War in Afghanistan. Thanks very much for coming on, Seth.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure.
Bye. And this is Booktown on KBMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and in the next couple of minutes, we're just going to talk about a couple of literary events coming up. First of all, I have that you just heard was Tom Wilson, who's one of the poets who are going to be celebrating the end of National Poetry Month right now, or very soon, because this is the end.
It's Friday night at the Broad Street Bistro from 6 to 8 p.m.
And what exactly is going to happen?
Well, to end the month, we just really want to celebrate those of us who are poets, the shoulders we stand on. We want to read great poetry from any age around the world. And, you know, people like Mary Oliver, Sylvia Plath, Whitman, Rumi, you know, E.E. Cummings. We're just going to read the best. And the theme really for the four poets is, what are the poems that really moved you? What are the memorable lines? Things that changed your life, you know, things like that. And you know, it's like Dylan Thomas said, a new poem changes the universe forever. And there are those poems out there, you know. So can I tell the poets?
Yes, that's what I'm
saying. The poets are going to be Alicia Vandervoorst, and she's a young woman. I think she's going to be one of the great poets that we know. And Ron Tranquilla, a person I go way back with. Marianne McDonald, who you may know, and myself. And then we're going to have a little musical interlude in the middle with a friend named Shabda, who does some beautiful classical guitar, and he's going to sing Gracias a la Vida for me. So it's going to be a nice night, and there's good food and drink and salads and soups and everything there, so it's going to be a great way to close it out.
Okay, and we only have a little bit of time left, but in that, do you want to read a little bit of one of the poems you're going to do? Or?
Yeah, I would. Could I do just two stanzas from two different poems?
Sure.
One, speaking of Dylan Thomas, I think that Fern Hill is maybe the greatest evocation of childhood, and here's a quick stanza from it. And then to awake, and the farm, like a wanderer white with dew, come back, the cock on his shoulder. It was all shining, it was Adam and maiden. The sky gathered again, and the sky grew round that very day. So it must have been after the birth of the simple light, in the first spinning place, the spellbound horses walking warm out of the whinnying green stable onto the fields of praise. Okay. Got time for another
one? One more, real fast.
Okay, this is a contemporary. Drew, oh God, I can't think of his name. I'm going too fast, but Drew Dellinger, and here it is. Is she radiant? Is she radiant? She's the sun's little sister. Her skin, smoother than the lily in Georgia O'Keeffe's mind. Her lips curve around a word like justice. Thanks, nice. Eric. Very generous
and
with you.
And it's going to be this Friday?
This Friday night, 6 to 8, Broad Street Bistro. Bring your friends. We'd love it. We're really going to close it out with beautiful poems.
Okay, and then one more event that's going to happen a week afterwards, Saturday, May 8th, which happens to be Mother's Day. There's going to be poetry and prose on motherhood, mothers, sons, and daughters at Sierra Mountain Coffee Roasters, 671 Maltman Drive in Grass Valley. And that's all the time we have time for. So stay tuned for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.